pretty that title. I don't think I even need to talk anymore. my name is Jessica Gutkick. I just arrived maybe 2 years ago at the University of Minnesota, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some kind of enzyme assay method development that we've been doing in the field in China in the last couple of years. So we all, I think it's pretty common knowledge, or it's well at least talked about, that the rhizosphere is this kind of hotbed for microbial activity. We know that there are lots and lots of labile rhizo deposits that fuel copiotrophic microbial communities. There's a lot of oxygen often released by roots. There's really high microbial biomass and possibly high levels of even priming of other decomposition of soil organic matter. So this idea of this, you know, rhizosphere, this nexus of activity is something that, you know, a lot of us really base our thoughts on when we go about studying soil ecology or soil microbial ecology. But some issues with this are that do we really understand it? Do we really understand how or if the rhizosphere is necessarily always this hotspot? Most of our measurements or our knowledge are based on very controlled, relatively artificial conditions so that we can tease apart these root processes either in the lab or a greenhouse experiment, very short-lived species, either agronomic species or grasses or other kind of easy to manipulate plant species, very few studies on long-lived species such as trees. And there's also, when we talk about the activity or this rhizosphere priming, there's actually a huge variance in what we actually observe, even in these artificial conditions. So even though we have a greenhouse and we've kind of made sure that we can control everything going on, we still, as in Wei-Jin Cheng's work, we still see huge variance in the actual level of priming or the level of activity. And so, you know, it appears that there are some kind of knowledge gaps or things that we might be missing in this situation. A really common way to measure microbial activity is through measuring the activity of extracellular enzymes. And for those who are unfamiliar with this, basically microbial cells and also some plants produce enzymes to degrade large polymeric molecules. This is cellulose. This is something that only microbes degrade. And they take this large polymeric molecule and use these specific enzymes to kind of chop this up into bits that can be taken up by the cell. Again, this is something, though, that we mostly only measure in pretty artificial potential-based assays in the lab. And so again, one of our main measurements is based on something that may or may not translate to actual field conditions or actual environmental conditions. And so the way that we have approached this, and this is just a short diagram and I'll go into much more detail in a minute, but the way that we have approached this is by modifying a method that Peter Baldrian and his colleagues have developed at their lab in Prague, where they've taken an agarose gel and embedded it with these enzyme substrates and then basically coated whatever object they want, so a leaf or a soil particle or whatever they're interested in, they embed that, and then they read the gel on a microplate reader to detect the fluorescence that's a typical way of measuring these enzyme activities. And so what we did was that we, in a similar approach, took an agarose gel and laid it on a root surface and trees in the field. Again, I'll show pictures in a minute. And then we measured this activity so that we could look more specifically at, you know, tree species growing in a field. They're not manipulated in the lab. We can look at the roots themselves versus the activity next to the roots, and we could get a sense of how this changes over an environmental gradient. To take a big step away from those details, the context of this work is a very large new forest biodiversity project in China. It's in southeastern China and the kind of in this border of Shaanxi and Zhejiang provinces. It's a subtropical, very highly diverse ecosystem. And just to give you, I'm not going to talk about this nearly at all, but just to give you an impression of the experiment, we have 53 hectares of land that have been planted with a total pool of 42 tree species. So it's a really unprecedented effort to look at forest biodiversity. They were planted in 2009 and 2010. And we also have many different diversity scenarios or ways that we've manipulated the tree diversity in planting this experiment. So what I'll focus on today are called our random extinction scenarios, and I'll only show a tiny bit of this, but basically we have from monoculture plots of only a single tree species planted to 2, 4, 8, and 16 tree species. And the way that this is structured, because it would be, even in this large of an experiment, it would be really unfeasible to have every combination of every tree species at every diversity level. You would need, I don't even know how much area you would need for that. And so what's been done here is called a broken stick model. So from our 16 species plot, where we have all 16 species, we basically break this in half randomly, and so half the species randomly go over here and half randomly go over here. And then we break that apart down through the diversity levels until we have the monocultures. And so what that does is we don't have each species combined with each species, but we can track pairs of species or groups of species as they change in diversity. And what we did in this experiment is we chose two pairs of two species. So we had four tree species and measured them along the diversity gradient. So we would have a pair that is in their own plot and then is combined with two species themselves. And then this pair is now combined with two more species up through the diversity gradient. And so we could track our two species as they're then becoming intermingled with other species and how this diversity gradient translates into a change in the rhizosphere processes. So just to give you a little more detail of what we did, we also, in this kind of crazy experiment, every single tree has its own label and is monitored itself every single year. So eventually we hope with this data to to translate this back to each individual tree and its own growth and its own traits and how those also vary across the gradient. And so we identified our trees. We then scraped away the soil to expose the roots, and then we, upon that freshly exposed soil, we laid our agarose gel that was embedded with these fluorescent substrates. And another thing that we did, if you're familiar with these enzyme assays, it's often important to have a control of your substrate. The substrates can go bad after a while, and we didn't know what this would be like in the field, and so we covered a little corner with Saran wrap as our kind of plate control for these assays. So then we took those back to the lab, and we let them incubate in the field for about half an hour, which for the level of this enzyme was completely enough time. And then we took them back to our field lab, where we have a plate reader to read the fluorescence. And we did this on the highest resolution setting we could put our plate reader at. So then the next, I've already said most of this. We had four tree species. We did three replicate trees in each plot. And we did three diversity levels that I'm going to show you today. So the three, the monocultures, the four, or the eight species. And we could only do one enzyme with this approach. And so we did phosphatase activity. This is something that happens to be produced both by plants and by microbes, but it's also one of the highest activities we have at our sites. And we have a lot of hypotheses about phosphorus limitation at our sites. So the next step was to then I made use of our imaging center at the University of Minnesota, which then helped me overlay a grid of what the plate would have been over the top of the roots. And then we coded the data and averaged for different steps of activity so that we could understand the activity at the root, on the root surface, the next step away, and then further away in the soil. And so you can see the root here, and here's this root surface with the steps away. So this is the way that we process the data, and what I'll show in the next slide is simply the average of the tree species and the same color coding to look at, or the same labeling to look at activity as we move further and further away from the roots. And so what we see for the two species plots is actually kind of interesting, and I'll talk about it both from the species effects and rhizosphere as a hotspot, but also in terms of method development. So you can see that for most of our species, we don't actually have a huge rhizosphere effect. We don't see that the activity on the roots is so much higher than anywhere else, except for necessarily one species, this Nyssa sinensis, where this is kind of slightly significant that we do see this decrease in activity as we move away from the root. So that supports the hypothesis that the root itself is kind of a hot spot, and the further you move away, the less activity there is. An odd thing about this data for all the species is that you'll notice that the furthest away cells actually have the highest activity and also the highest variance. So I think that there could be both a biological or a methodological reason for this. The biological reason could be that as you move away from the roots, you're moving further and further from the kind of copiotrophic communities that are feeding off these really juicy, easy-to-eat labile substrates that the plants are releasing. And so these could also be the microbes, as you move further away, that rely more on enzymes to get their nutrients or to get the nutrients that they need to grow. That could be the biological reason. The methodological reason, which is just as plausible, is that on the edges of the plate, we had to really we had to find the line between agarose that was soft enough to really make good contact, but not too soft. And sometimes the very edges of the plates were really hard, or the edges of the gels were really hard to fully wash away from soil particles or things. And so it's likely that we saw, at least in some cases, higher activity on the edges because they were harder to keep pristine for doing this assay. So then if we move a step forward to look at the tree diversity, this is our first species, Castanea henryi. The one species, four species, and eight species. And so this was a species that there was no difference in activity at all close to the roots or further from the roots. And what you see is that, especially in the eight species plot, this is, again, probably not significant, but we're starting to see that there is a slight increase in activity, at least a trend, at the root surface. But the other thing that I actually found really interesting when we start moving along the diversity gradient is that the variance is much, much higher. And so to me that suggests that, we only had three replicates, and so it might not have been enough to detect really subtle differences anyways, but also it could be that, it's not necessarily a species-wide effect that we're observing. It could be even an individual tree effect. And so a next step of digging through this data is to look at the specific neighborhood. As I mentioned, we label and keep track of every tree in this experiment. And so could it be that, the plasticity of response varies even from a tree individual to another tree individual, and that we're starting to see this big variance when we try to look at a whole species effect over the diversity gradient. We see similar effects. So here's the Nyssa sinensis, where we saw a stronger, a stronger gradient of decreasing activity away from the roots, and we still sort of see that. But again, especially at the eight species level, we're seeing much, much higher variance. And so, again, there's something going on that the individual trees are responding really differently or changing how they prime the microbial community along this diversity gradient. So just to give some conclusions, we demonstrated that different tree species on whole could have varying levels of heightened rhizosphere activity. So for one species, we saw a pretty nice gradient, and for the other species, we didn't see anything at all. And this could be for a couple of reasons. There's been some evidence that trees simply don't prime quite as much as other, like grassland species that invest so much in their roots. There's also been some hypothesis that ectomycorrhizal tree species versus endomycorrhizal tree species have different priming effects, or that endomycorrhizal species, or the ectomycorrhizal species, so the type of mycorrhizal fungi associated with these tree species could alter their level of priming or alter their level of heightened activity in the rhizosphere. Also, we found that even individuals or different tree species respond differently over the diversity gradient. So over this diversity gradient, there are varying levels of the response in this rhizosphere priming. And then finally, that got a little bit cut off, but as I mentioned, the method itself could use further development to make sure that we're really getting good contact with the soil, but that we're not sacrificing the results that we get. And so we're looking forward to kind of playing with this method a little bit more in the field. So with that, do I have any time for questions?
Yes.
One time for maybe
yes.
one question. So, oh, and this is just a bit of stories from the field. This is the group of workers to plant all the trees at our site. It was a tremendous, tremendous effort. And this is my PhD student who did a lot of this work. So, and literally, this is the slope that we work at when we go to the field. So, thank you. Yeah.